You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Thomas Jefferson wore many hats over his long career: governor, ambassador, secretary of state, vice president, president, and, of course, author of the Declaration of Independence. He achieved all of them during one of America's most challenging periods, a time of transition, staunch partisanship, and external threat. John Meacham discusses how he overcame many of those obstacles in his latest book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Mr. Meacham is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of American Lion and executive editor and executive vice president of Random House, which has published this new book. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Thank you, sir.
Why does the image of Jefferson seem to keep changing with every new biography? I mean, we pretty much know everything he did, don't we?
Well, we may know what he did, but why he did it is one of the points of biography. You know, President Kennedy said that the point of biography is, what was he like? What was he really like? And that's one of the reasons I love doing what I do. James Parton, a 19th century biographer, said that if America is right, then Jefferson is right. If Jefferson was wrong, then America is wrong. It's a hell of a burden to put on any one person. And nobody says that about George Washington or Alexander Hamilton or John Adams. And I think that's because, and the reason Jefferson attracts perennial interest, is he represents the best of us and the worst of us.
And to some degree, certain contradictory impulses in American politics.
Totally. There's clearly the question of equality and race, which we know. There's also, in a more political sense, he was a small government philosopher who governed when he needed to as a big government authoritarian. My argument is that Jefferson managed to use Hamiltonian means to achieve Jeffersonian ends.
He was also a Democrat, mm-hmm. In the small d, although I guess the Democratic Party to some degree could be seen as part of his legacy. But he was also a critic of cities, which is where most Democrats live in this country, according to the latest election
right.
results.
Exactly. Well, you know, his disposition was always to try to figure out a way so that the many would have a role in self-government as opposed to the few. And for him, he did have this agrarian vision, except when he had a commercial vision. All the world is becoming commercial, he said. And he was he opposed internal improvements, but he wrote brilliantly about the importance of canals and roads. One of the things about Jefferson is he lived so long and wrote so well that he left this long paper trail, sort of like the Bible and Churchill.
And he wrote the Declaration of Independence because people recognized that he mm-hmm. wrote so well.
He said, John Adams said, you're 10 times the writer I am. And John Adams regretted that the rest of his life because, you know, the Declaration of Independence was sort of a sideshow in real time. And then as it achieved this sacred status and Jefferson became the author, John Adams said it was all a theatrical performance and Jefferson ran away with all the glory of it.
Well, would Adams have written something all that different? It may not have been as beautifully said.
I think that the Declaration, to some extent, the eloquence is the, at least in the first part of the Declaration, the eloquence is the meaning in many ways. The Bill of Particulars, I mean, more than, you know, a huge part of the Declaration is these alleged causes for revolution that even some people in real time weren't sure what they were.
A number of reviewers have pointed out that books like this will be read very much for their relevance in the current situation. What similarities do you see between the politics of his time and now?
Well, you know, their lives are particular. We cannot rip them from their context. But they have perennial significance, and they did deal with, broadly put, many of the forces that we deal with. He saw that in terms of Jefferson said that men have divided themselves by opinion into parties since those questions convulsed Greece and Rome. So he saw parallels in that world. I think that it's partisanship. It's an attempt for America to continually redefine its role in the world. And how do you divide? How do you govern in a way where the resources of the country are best marshaled?
Well, how did he confront staunch partisanship?
He became a staunch partisan while talking about the need for cooperation. He was the founder of the first great opposition party in the country. He and James Madison came on a trip up here to New York from Philadelphia, and were really calling on Republicans in New York, Aaron Burr and others, who were going to be critical to the creation of an opposition to the Federalist government. And one of the things that I find fascinating about him is he was a quintessential pragmatist in that he had a principled vision of one thing, and that was the survival and success of the American experiment. Short of breaking that principle, he would cut almost any deal.
And you write, a politician's task was to bring reality and policy into the greatest possible accord with the ideal and principle.
Right.
Well, we're hearing people saying that compromise is really capitulation today.
Well, the middle way is not always the right way, but it often is. And so, yes, I mean, Winston Churchill should not have compromised in May of 1940, but not everything is Munich. And not everything is sort of a cataclysmic existential choice. Richard Hofstadter was brilliant on this in The Paranoid Style in American Politics, a piece that's now, good Lord, almost 50 years old.
Now, you've called your book The Art of Power. Robert Caro could probably have called his books on Lyndon Johnson The Art of Power. But we're talking about two very different ways of dealing with power.
We're talking about different ways, but, you know, the human appetites are common. Lyndon Johnson and Thomas Jefferson both had enormous appetites for women, for power, for affection, for respect, for esteem. And one of the things that I think is important about Jefferson is if even arguably the most interesting and fascinating American who ever lived, deeply flawed but deeply important, if he was a working politician and was able to make the world a little bit better than it had been when he came on the stage, then I hope that gives us all a little bit of reassurance that politics itself, can in fact be a means of progress.
But he was not one of these guys who threw his arm around you and convinced you to vote his way.
He didn't touch you, no, but he would work you. Charming conversation, his eyes, he had a way of looking at you that was very seductively. He was also a tireless entertainer. Every night that Congress was in session, he had a dinner for lawmakers. He didn't mix, by the way. This wasn't a kind of Simpson Bowles thing. He didn't want Democrats. He didn't want Republicans and Federalists. He wanted all one or all the other because he did see, as most of his successors have done, he saw the president as the center of things.
But he didn't give speeches. Were speeches important in those days, or is that something that develops later?
That was a little later. And in fact, John Adams commended Jefferson for not speaking in assemblies because no one ever convinces anyone and you just annoy people.
There are lots of questions that occur to one in reading the book. How would he react to the way the United States is today? Or one that I thought of is, as a slave owner, who do you think Jefferson would have voted for in the last election?
Well, here's one of the richest ironies in all of this. Thomas Jefferson and many, many of his contemporaries could not imagine a biracial society. You know, even the most among the most advanced positions on emancipation also involved repatriation and colonization. So even
that's how we wind up with Monrovia in Africa.
Precisely. But one of the irony is Jefferson could not imagine a biracial society. And yet he presided over one at Monticello and created one. And I think that, you know, he in that sense, he's very, very much a man of his time, and that the promise that he articulated is still being fulfilled.
We also had a biracial family.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, he created the one.
Yeah. Well, but we have no idea whether he loved Sally Hemings or whether she was just his mistress.
We don't have any idea. It's one of the great mysteries of that very murky relationship is what did he feel? Did he feel anything? You know, the children that were born of that union were recorded in the farm book. Was it simply a utilitarian relationship? Jefferson had very utilitarian views about sex, as did many people in those days. He saw it as a critical element. But that was a connection that went on for 40 years until the day he died. And it was arguably the longest relationship with any woman other than his mother in his whole life.
Well, he was a widower. He wasn't having an affair on the side.
No, no. His wife died when he was in midlife, 40, 41. It's one of the reasons I find that the skeptics about the Hemming story so implausible, because the idea that a man who had such endless appetites would stop short in midlife at such a virile stage strains credulity.
But he didn't free his children from Sally, did he?
Yes, he did. The only people who were freed in Jefferson's will were members of the Hemings family.
My guest is John Meacham, whose latest book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Was it preordained that he would go into politics because of his family status?
He was definitely going to go to the House of Burgesses. That was just part of the eldest son of an estate in that part of Virginia would have done that. But to rise from local prominence to national and international prominence required a level of ambition that I think was created, inculcated, and nourished there in Williamsburg.
And do we see a certain consistency? Is the young man pretty much the person we recognize later? Because he did spend time in Europe, for example, and saw the Enlightenment firsthand, a little different than the Enlightenment in the colonies in the early states.
True. The idea is, though, I think there's a man named William Small, who was his professor at William and Mary, who was a man of the Enlightenment. He's one of these people that to whom Americans owe a great debt, but no one knows who he is, because if he had not been there, it's arguable who would have introduced Jefferson to the Scottish Enlightenment or the French Enlightenment. And so Jefferson changed in that he became ever more expert in the art of politics. He was a failure as the governor of Virginia during the Revolutionary War.
He was accused of being a coward.
Right. He did not react quickly enough, calling out the militia to fight off Cornwallis and Benedict Arnold. He fled Monticello. I've never liked that image, because what would we have had him do? Be captured as a prisoner? Have the author of the Declaration of Independence and the governor of Virginia become a prisoner of war? Would that have been preferable somehow? But he was – I believe that there's a direct line between the cataclysm of his governorship, which he hated. I mean, he hated criticism like nothing else, which is interesting that he went into that field of work. But he then – when the Louisiana crisis in 1803 came up, he did not hesitate. He had learned hesitation exacted too high a price.
Well, he's a founding father, and then he becomes a diplomat. So does his diplomatic experience help him later when he winds up becoming Secretary of State, Vice President, and President?
Oh, yeah. I think the example in France, and, you know, we were dealing with – he was based in France, also visited John Adams in England. They negotiated with bankers in Holland. He traveled around. He was very much a man who saw, as he put it, that it is wisest in a system like ours to give as well as to take. And I think realizing that, experiencing the diplomatic game, and again, these very fundamental economic negotiations, I think were critical to giving him a more sophisticated sense of politics.
He fell in love with French culture, with French wine, French food. His family was from England. Did he feel any connections to England?
He didn't. It's interesting. And in fact, his hostility toward Great Britain is one of the great defining forces in his life. I argue in the book that you can't really understand early American history without seeing the struggle between 1763 and 1815 with Britain as a 50-year war that was sometimes hot, sometimes cold. And he feared the reassertion of British power and forms and, in fact, perhaps explicit government at every point, and it shaped his life.
My guest is John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, it's published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with John Meacham, who won the Pulitzer Prize for American Lion, his best-selling 2008 biography of Andrew Jackson. He's also the author of the New York Times bestsellers Franklin and Winston and American Gospel. His latest is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. It is published by Random House, where he also serves as an executive. Usually people do not publish in the same house that they work. Is it because publishing has shrunk so much you almost have no choice?
Well, there's that, and I've been a Random House author for good Lord, 16 years. My authorial relationship predated my editorial.
Now, we mentioned that he was born into aristocracy, large tracts of land, many slaves. As a man of the Enlightenment, did he ever reject the privileged society he was born into, or at least question it?
Absolutely. He took three or four steps toward reforming slavery, both as a lawyer and as a young legislator and as the author of the Declaration and as a member of the Confederation Congress, drafting an ordinance that would have banned slavery in new territories. He lost every round, often decisively and often in a highly public way. And as a political creature, he did not like losing decisively or in a highly public way. And about 1785, he essentially gave up. And if he had died in 1785, he would have been a lodestar of quotations, a kind of precursor to emancipation. He would have a radically different historical reputation on this. But his life was made possible by slavery. His first memory was of being handed up to a slave on a horse while Jefferson was on a pillow as a child. The very end of his life, as he's trying to signal on his deathbed a level of discomfort, his white family didn't understand what he meant, and it was an enslaved butler who understood, fixed the pillow, mm-hmm. and made him comfortable. His whole life was made possible by this institution, and his failure to reform it, his failure to address it, is the great epic sin and failing of his life.
But he also moved to ban slavery in the new territories at mm-hmm. the same time that he did not imagine freeing any of his slaves in Monticello.
Except for members of the Hemings family. That's yeah. right.
Well, there was also a money problem, wasn't there?
He was a terrible spendthrift, yeah. Thank God there weren't credit cards. It would have been worse. He would have had to consolidate one of those late night ads. He was a planter. I mean, that's something we also have to remember. And what did Virginia planters do? They borrowed money, they owned slaves, and they went into debt.
His closest ally was Madison, also from Virginia. Were their backgrounds similar? Did they share many similar experiences?
Yes, they were. Madison's mother was related to Martha Washington. Madison, the interesting difference is Madison went north to the College of New Jersey, which became Princeton, under John Witherspoon, and had a bit more of a cosmopolitan education, interestingly, than Jefferson, who just went to William and Mary.
You quote Jefferson as saying, "Cherish, therefore, the spirit of our people and keep alive their attention. Do not be too severe upon their errors, but reclaim them by enlightening them." Mm-hmm. Is that a way of saying he believed in the bully pulpit as a president?
And in freedom of expression. He resisted again and again laws like the Alien and Sedition Act. He did not believe that the first resort of the federal government to any sort of civil dispute should be force. And so he worried about the Whiskey Rebellion. He worried about Shays' Rebellion. He worried about the Federalist tendency to be harsh on dissent.
He also worried about the possibility that the federal government would impose taxes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was...
Which is where he wound up at loggerheads with Hamilton.
Exactly, among many things. Of Hamilton, he said that he refused to endure the slanders of a man to whom history, from the moment history could stoop to notice him, had the country had taken him in and given him bread and heaped its honors upon his head.
That's because Hamilton was born in Bermuda, was he? Or was it Kenya?
Nevis,
I can't remember.
Nevis. let's not be an anachronistic.
Oh, it was Nevis. Okay.
That's right. No one checked Jefferson's birth certificate. That's a good point. He and Hamilton were oil and water, obviously, and there's much truth in the tendency to encapsulate these two traditions. My sense of Jefferson, though, again, is, and in fact Hamilton recognized this, is that Jefferson had a Burkean streak in him. He dealt with reality as he found it. And what's hard, I think, about that is he was so eloquent for so long that you can quote him as a radical when in fact he was a realist when he actually governed.
And didn't he make some accommodations with Hamilton?
Oh, of course. And in fact, they...
Somebody said that the president and John Boehner should look at this part of your book.
Well, there's something to it. Jefferson found Hamilton outside Washington's house one day looking haggard, as he put it. And it was about the federal debt assumption and whether the government would be financially able to take a central place in the life of the country. It was being held up in the House by James Madison, among others, because the South was unhappy. So Jefferson had convened a dinner, and they sat down, and a deal was ultimately struck where the South got the capital on the Potomac, Hamilton got federal assumption, and we were off to make history. Again, I don't want to make too much of the idea that compromise is always the way to go, because there are principled matters on which one should not compromise. But that's the exception, not the rule, it seems to me. And it certainly seemed that way to Jefferson, who was able to govern and shape the life of the country by speaking often in idealistic ways but always acting pragmatically.
John Meacham is my guest. His book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that Jefferson founded the most formidable dynasty in American history. What do you mean by that?
From 1800 to 1840, for 36 of those years, either Thomas Jefferson himself or a self-described Jeffersonian was president of the United States.
Even though a few Whigs became president during that time?
That was later.
Oh, really?
This was Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, a break for Adams, 8 years of Jackson, 4 more years of Van Buren. And Van Buren was still running in 1840 as a self-described Jeffersonian.
Mm-hmm. And they all pretty much shared Jefferson's ideas?
Somebody
like Jackson is quite different in other ways, isn't it?
Oh, and absolutely. In fact, I should have saved writing the Jackson biography for my retirement, because whenever he got mad, he shot someone, which was easy narratively. Jefferson would write a letter. Yes. The basic orientation of Jeffersonian republicanism was to preserve a role for the many over the few. And there was it's a consistent strain. I think we're still seeing it to some extent. And the idea of claiming the sense of claiming the mantle of Jefferson, it was so real to them and continues.
And when did that change? Why did it change?
Partly the Civil War,
that's later. We're talking about 25 years after.
Oh, well, in 1840, with the politics of empire, and that sort of ran out in a way. But Jefferson, Merrill Peterson wrote a whole book about this, the Jefferson image in the American mind. He can be used to talk about the importance of union. He can be used to talk about secession. He can be used to talk about revolution. He can be used to talk about stability. And, my sense of him is he was so multifaceted, but he was multifaceted in the way many politicians are, because he was trying to put together coalitions in a given moment to solve a given problem.
He could also be used to talk about religion in this country and its role in American politics. He rewrote the New Testament.
He rearranged.
What does that reveal about his religious views?
Well, it reveals no lack of editorial ambition.
Chutzpah.
I will say, exactly. I know a lot of editors with a lot of egos, and that's unmatched. He was I don't think he was a deist in the sense of the way we think of it. I think he was he believed in the cultural cohesion that religion could offer. He ferociously believed in religious liberty. He and Madison were critical architects of that tradition. I think it's one of the greatest things that American life has to offer ourselves and the world. And he was the one who introduced what had been a phrase of Richard Hooker's that Roger Williams had also used about the wall of separation between church and state in a letter. Which we're still debating. And in his sense, I believe, is that church and state had to be separate. It was a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association written on New Year's Day, 1802. It's a classic document. But he also understood that politics and religion couldn't ultimately be separated out. And so we had to be eternally vigilant so that we did not tend toward a theocratic direction.
Now, he, as we said earlier, he served as ambassador to France. Mm-hmm. Is that why we wind up later with the Louisiana Purchase? Did he develop those kinds of connections, or is that just coincidental?
No, that was coincidental because Napoleon had a series of problems that could not have been anticipated.
But Napoleon wasn't even in power when Jefferson was there.
Right. So that was a case. It was Jefferson left France in late 89. To come back, he arrived back in Norfolk, found out he was been offered the Secretary of State job, and then it was 13 years later when Napoleon made, arguably, and this is an important point for New Yorkers, a really bad real estate deal.
What did Jefferson think of George Washington when he was his Secretary of State?
He worried that Washington was being manipulated by a master in Alexander Hamilton, and worried that, as he once put it, Washington was not a first-rate intellect in Jefferson's view. And so he worried that there could be flattery, there could be manipulation. And the truth is somewhere in between, I think. It's unquestionable that Washington tacked toward a Federalist view of the world, and Jefferson strongly believed in the other direction. There were ferocious fights in this cabinet. As Jefferson said of himself and Hamilton, they were daily pitted in the cabinet like two cocks. Washington wrote a letter to both of them saying that your fights are harrowing and tearing our vitals. Harrowing and tearing our vitals. It's a very un-Washington thing to write. And you know, for a man who loved order, you know, the idea of these two, if his Secretary of State and his Secretary of the Treasury at each other's throats all the time, I'd argue the country benefited from it, having that vigorous exchange of ideas.
What about his rivalry with John Adams?
They were the greatest frenemies in American history. They began as close allies in the Continental Congress. They were abroad together. They fell out substantially in the early 1790s over federalism versus republicanism, ran against each other in 1796. Jefferson lost, became vice president. They ran against – he then ran against Adams again in 1800. And, you know, it took 1800s a complicated election. They then – with one exception, Abigail Adams wrote Jefferson when Jefferson's daughter died in 1804. And they had an exchange that went bad quickly because Abigail blamed Jefferson for funding a newspaper man, which in those days meant propagandist, for attacking Adams. And so they started basically arguing back and forth. The correspondence stops. Finally, after he's out of the White House, Benjamin Rush, who is sort of the Cyrano de Bergerac of this argument, of this part of the history.
The painter Benjamin Rush?
The physician from Philadelphia. And he told John Adams, Jefferson really, really wants you to write him. And he told Jefferson that Adams did. And suddenly all of life is fundamentally high school.
Well, I would think that the Alien and Sedition Acts would have really separated them. And some people feel that that has permanently tarred John Adams in history, even though he was pretty good on a lot of other things.
I think that's right. But permanently tarred, I think, is a relative term because when you
just set it off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
Well, no, you're exactly right. But let's think of him in his totality. If you think about Jefferson, the embargo of 1807, 1808 was a disastrous policy, but he was doing the best he could in real time. This is very important to me. The idea that a historical figure has to accord 100% to our retrospective standards is an unreasonable standard and one that doesn't serve history very well.
A listener wants to know about Jefferson's interests in science.
Oh, deep, wide and deep. He very much wanted the president's house to be a center of culture and science. He actually had two grizzly cubs on the White House lawn. He put artifacts from the Lewis and Clark expedition in a room in the White House, invited people to come and look at the fossils. He could be wrong. He thought there were salt, mountains of salt in the West and that sort of thing. But he believed so much, and I would argue this is what sets him apart from Adams and Hamilton and Washington, of that core group of founders. Jefferson was the one who believed most in the possibilities of humanity and the fact that tomorrow could be more interesting and better than today.
Do you think it's also because he had that artistic bent? I mean, he turns out to have been a really great architect.
I do think it was that. I think it was an endless curiosity. I think that he was curious about everything. Art, architecture, wine, food, women, politics, power, history, books, Homer. You know, it went on and on and on. And it, I think I trace it to his father had a fairly standard upper-class library of those days, Shakespeare and Addison and Steele and that sort of thing. But really William and Mary and Williamsburg in the 1760s was a critical phase. I don't think it gets much attention, and I try to rectify that.
The book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, John Meacham's book, from Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leonard. I appreciate it. This was fun.